Our next speaker is Melanie Sawwell, who of course is one of the key organisers of this event. Melanie is Associate Professor in Screen and Media at Flinders University. She's project leader on this multidisciplinary linkage project and my partner in crime called Play It Again, which this event obviously is connected with. And Melanie also has one of those rare things, an ARC Future Fellowship. She's which is wonderful, and she's researching the history of creative microcomputing in Australia between 1976 and 1992. Together with Denise DeVries as well, she runs the Australasian Heritage Software Database, and her talk today is titled, there were glasses here too, is titled Homebrew Gaming and Everyday Reception of Microcomputers, which is some of the research that is part of a book that Melanie's working on.
Thanks, Melanie.
Thanks very much, Angela. Okay. Homebrew gaming references the act of non-professionals creating software, often games. This practice of non-professionals writing games took off in the long 1980s, when 8-bit microcomputers came within the reach of everyday users. If homebrew practices are acknowledged at all in the literature on computing and software history, they tend to be treated dismissively, as in software historian Campbell Kelly's characterisation of homebrew creations as amateurish. Campbell Kelly talks of bedroom coders as would-be software tycoons, whose games usually consisted of smudgy photocopied instructions in a bag, which usually disappointed their purchasers. Is it hard to think how anyone could do a better hatchet job? Is this warranted? Sorry, it is hard to think how anyone could do a better hatchet job on homebrew. Is this warranted? Well, possibly. Matthew Hall, Steve Faulkner were here 2 years ago in the Australian Story Games panel that Helen Stuckey, my colleague, put together for Game Masters. And both talked about the inexpensive games they either purchased or distributed using such a method. Now, I won't go through and read this, but Matthew Hall really liked cheap games. He said he was growing up in the country in Victoria, and you know, if it was $2, it was better than a $3 game because you could get more. But as he also has pointed out, budget games were a mixed bag. Some were really good. Meanwhile, Steve Faulkner recounted how he was one of those people who would go along to conventions and distribute his games in Glad Wrap sandwich bags. But I want to suggest that it's also not very fair to judge the quality of the packaging of games that are being produced in this time by 8- and 9-year-olds, as these two were when they wrote their first games. Furthermore, I'm going to suggest that it actually misses the point of the significance of this activity to judge them on their packaging. What was remarkable and significant about the activity of homebrew creation is precisely that it was not some pale imitation of a still-forming commercial software production industry. So in this paper, I want to frame the discussion differently and focus it in on homebrew as an instance of people's early involvement with computers, and so an important chapter in digital cultural history. And I want to hark back to the point that Henry raised in his keynote this morning. I'm very concerned with the question of future understandings of this period as, you know, the 1980s as seen from 2050, not so much. I mean, I think it matters now how we see the period, but also I'm looking ahead to the future. To date, few computer historians have shown much interest in microcomputers more generally, preferring to research and write about the big computers, those that had individual names, rather than the little ones, which, even at the time, were deemed to be too much like toys to warrant serious attention. It's clear where the allegiances lie in this version of history, with the winners, the successful commercial enterprises, the big name producers, and famous machines. It is, however, only one perspective on the history of computing and software production at this time. Something similar could be said about tendencies in games history and historiography. The big names, the successful production, and less focus on the consumption end of things. By contrast, I want to suggest that homebrew in the 80s is significant because it's a moment when users are experimenting with what they can do with a computer at the time when computers are new. And, let's be frank, beyond writing and playing games, have very few established uses within the home. In fact, a whole debate raucous, and I won't read that out, but I really like the way that they describe the way in which users envisaged new things that you could do with the computer based on their own interests, and then they would share these. Graham Phillipson, a local journalist, put it slightly differently when he wrote, quote, "Many people who bought expensive and underpowered PCs wondered what to do with them," end quote. I assume this comment is intended to be derogatory, but it can be taken literally. Wondering what to do with something frequently leads to experimentation and to new uses being found. Such wondering on the part of hobbyists enabled them to see opportunities for developing new programs that would be useful in a field of their own interest or expertise. So judging from the amount of column inches devoted to it in magazines, the reports I've had from my informants, and the number of titles we've discovered in our research in Australia and New Zealand in the Play It Again project, writing games at home was one of the most common uses that were made of that was made of early home computers. Homebrew creators often taught themselves how to code, typically, though not only, in BASIC, through self-study and trial and error. And there's many, many examples I could give of this. Matthew Hall talks about when he started making games at the age of 8. He got a Commodore 64 for his birthday. He says, "And I got one game, which was a game called The Pit. It's rather obscure and it's really shit. And the other thing I got, of course, was a manual. And so the game I finished very quickly, and then I had nothing else to do, so I dove straight into the manual. And you know, going out and trying to find books wherever I could, I did that for quite a long time." And he gestures to the magazines that he was reading at the time, some of which were local, some of which were coming from the UK. And he said, "I didn't even know at that point there were games being made in Australia. There was Melbourne House, but I had no idea that was actually the Melbourne that was right near us. I was very young." There are lots more examples I could give of this. But something that I really pick up in these accounts is that there's an excitement that's attached to this activity. It comes through strongly in the oral histories. And this example, well, there we go. There's some examples of some books. One example of this, I think, that comes where it comes across quite nicely is in this quote from Catherine Neal, where she talks about a computer back in the day being an expensive toy. And she compares it to people using computers for worky things now. But she says, whereas back then it was like a cool novelty. It was like a Ferrari or something. It was like a Sunday drive. It was a luxury car you drove around in on a Sunday, not a commuter vehicle that you sit in traffic jams every day in. So Homecoder's involvement with the computer as a fun toy laid the ground for an everyday creative engagement with computers, a messing around with computers and a seeing what was possible. This is consistent with another contemporary's characterisation, Rudy Hess, of the computer fan or hobbyist as, quote, "someone who appreciates the options, fun, excitement and fiendish fascination of computers." Some nice alliteration there. But it occurs against a backdrop where opinions amongst the general non-hobbyist population were split as to whether early micros were useful at all, or whether they were effectively useless in their then current form because of a lack of software, for instance. Now, attitudes changed over the course of the decade. None of the claimed early uses in the 80s seemed to have adequately caught the public's imagination. There were all sorts of claims that, you know, you could use your computer for recipe filing or for financial management, but none of these were really could really be considered the killer app, I suggest. It seemed to take until much later in the decade when very practical applications such as printing personalised stationery and Garfield cartoons came out, and these seemed to strike a chord with a much wider market. So homebrew and home coding more generally was a niche practice, but also, somewhat strangely, many of those who dabbled at writing software at home, after school or on the weekend considered that their activity was unremarkable in the sense that everyone was doing it. And here's some examples of some bright young things as they were characterised. This may be one reason why it's overlooked, because of its everydayness. People such as these guys, they knew others who were doing it. At the same time, many of these schoolboys and schoolgirls, and that's what they were often, and teenage boys and young men particularly, as in the case of this guy, John Perry, a New Zealander, realised that not everyone was doing it, and they risked being stigmatised by the activity if they were perceived as being too deeply involved with computers. So it's paradoxical. So at what is the beginning of the digital age for many, we have schoolboys and schoolgirls working in domestic space with limited resources. And because it's in domestic space, it's been a kind of a hidden practice. These users get computing and programming in a way that the wider public doesn't. Amongst this group of users writing games and other software, but mostly games, was a popular activity that was a big part of their everyday lives. They write games based on the popular culture influences that are around them, Star Wars and other films and popular cultural references, and they draw on vernacular influences and references. Idiomatic titles appear, like Mozzie Zapper, and here's one that's kind of timely, The Young Ones. Nick Morenti's family, a TRS 80 author, owns a donut kiosk, and so he thinks, quote, occasionally something would go wrong with the donut machine, usually in the part that flips the donut over and the donuts would get all messed up. Seeing this one day, a revelation hit me. Why not do a game based at a donut factory where everything has gone wrong, end quote. So he makes his own platformer with 10 levels, including the fat splurter and the icing sugar sprinkler. It's apparently a really good game. He thinks his best for the TRS-80. So responding again to Campbell Kelly, what's perhaps remarkable is that some of these games were as good as they seem to have been. Homebrew creators dealt mostly with other users. For the most part, then, homebrew remained a practice that, in de Certeau's terms, produced without capitalising. Even amongst those who aspired and managed to create profitable businesses out of it, for the most part, their dealings remained with other users. Arthur Streeter and Daryl Reynolds are two homebrew creators who are on the edge of this, who I've recently interviewed, because they made quite a good amount of money from selling their basic games through mail order. Reynolds had the odd international distribution arrangement, even. But he was in a different league to those who were in the industry proper. For instance, as a one-man band, he mailed out the cheat sheets to his adventure games from home to those who got stuck and needed a bit of extra help. So contacts were mostly with other users and were almost exclusively local. So to sum up, what does the study of 1980s homebrew practices contribute to an understanding of the reception of microcomputers? Without wanting to romanticise the period, the homebrew case study provides a chance to remember and recapture something of the time when computing was new and to grasp what it meant for everyday users. Homebrew provides instances of vernacular computer consumption. These users were located in domestic space, not in commercial studios. And the stories they tell of their experiences are usually local in scope, with interactions remaining predominantly with other users. It was highly experimental, and all were unashamedly making it up as they went. Users could easily envisage uses for computers at this time, and it was still possible to execute these ideas solo. Making it up as they went was an entirely appropriate response to what was a then new technology. And homebrew, I would also say, is not immediately visible, if not invisible, or at least it has been till I started digging into it. There's been a need to go looking for it. This was some thoughts I was having when Maria was talking about the demo scene as a community. The homebrew scene, I don't think I would characterise it as a community as such. There were magazines, certainly, that people bought and consumed, which provided a kind of fora, but many people were working alone and were quite isolated. So studying homebrew reveals a history not of great men or great productions in computing, but of schoolboys and girls and interested adults with typically local aspirations, having a go, learning as they went, and sometimes breaking through. The 1980s, while sometimes judged not sufficiently distant to be historical, is, I argue, highly significant in the history of how we became digital. And this vernacular case study warrants remembering as part of this significant transition in cultural history, as well as the professional game titles and histories. While the fashions of the era often make us chuckle or wince, it's a key period in the transition from analog to digital ways of living, as it is when most people come into first contact with a computer. And it's a cultural historical moment that we're fast losing touch with as we increasingly carry computers around in our pockets. So it's hard to kind of recapture that sense of, you know, when they were new, but it is the challenge. And so I suppose just as a bit of a afterward, I would like to reflect kind of on methodology. It's a funny spot to do it, I guess, but Henry's questions this morning about, you know, the software archive or the software library. I'd like to say that because Homebrew is kind of hidden, I've been using both the software archive, or I hope to use the software archive, which doesn't actually exist yet, so I'm in the process of developing it, as well as the software library, and I'm having to generate that as I go as well. So there will be a case study and there will be an archive and a library at the end of this project. Thanks very much.